How's everybody doing? My name is Paul Betts, and I will be talking to you about SQLite. So, why Akavash is fast? How not to use SQLite? Because I used it the incorrect way for a long time and then figured out my mistakes. So we're going to talk about it. I'm Paul Betts. I write a lot of Xamarin libraries. Today, this talk is a little different because a lot of my talks are like how to use this and that, like how to use Reactive UI or how to use Akavash or how to use these different libraries. This talk is a little different. This talk is like going to talk about how this library works. So if you're interested in how to use this library, then this will be very under-informative. But the plus side is we're going to learn a little bit about SQLite and how it works. And some pitfalls that are really easy to do in practice, even though, even if you're really careful. Cool. So I work at Slack. I work on their desktop client, their Mac and Windows and Linux client. Before that, I worked at GitHub, where I wrote a lot of the software. Akavash was a pull from the GitHub for Windows desktop client. So it was built into GitHub for Windows, and we were like, this is a great library. We should spin it out and give it to everyone else. So what is Akavash? Akavash is a made-up word. You cannot mispronounce it because I just made it up. It's like it is a mashup of the phrase asynchronous persistent key value store, or persistent key value cache is how it's mashed up. Kind of like the Japanese word for personal computer is like pazokan, like personal computer. Yeah. So it's asynchronous, it is not blocking. It's persistent, which means it saves to some sort of thing. You come back to it and you get the same thing back. And it's a key value store. What's a key value store? So key value store is basically, this is basically the data structure that that Akavash gives you. It's a dictionary of string to byte array. And that dictionary, if you put a key into it, and then kill your app and then restart it, you can get that key back. That's like, at the end of the day, that's kind of all it is. And so on top of that, what can we do with byte dictionaries? Well, we could serialize objects. We could take JSON objects and, or we could take objects and use JSON.NET to convert them into byte arrays, right? Because we can convert them to strings, we can take strings and convert them to byte arrays. Actually, internally, Akavash uses this library called BSON, which is a binary serialized format of JSON, which is more efficient because you have less redundancy. Fetching and loading images and URLs from the internet. So downloading an image is obviously like a byte dictionary, right? One thing that's neat that we can do is that because inserting and getting keys from a key value dictionary is so straightforward, it's really easy to put something in between the inserts and the gets. So like we can create kind of a wrapper around this byte dictionary and then make it encrypt and decrypt user credentials using like on Windows we'd use like cryptprotect and like on iOS we'd use kind of the built-in like encryption functions. So at the end of the day, so Akavash was built with like this like pluggable backend. You could like put different, you could use different backends for it. But then I realized the only one that was worth anything was the SQLite one, and the other ones were poorly written by me, and they didn't work right, so we got rid of them. And so Akavash uses SQLite to store data. So you can use SQLite tables to store key-value elements. Because you can just create a table, and that's the exact definition that I pulled from a database, from a SQL or from an Akavash cache: key, type name, value, expiration, and created at. So there's just key and value. Key is a string, and value is a blob. And then we got some other stuff, but that's like the core idea is that just one big table that has keys and values. So I talked to a bunch of people like who work at Xamarin, like Anuj and and some other folks, and they say that they moved to Akabash from SQLite. So they're using SQLite internally. And they're like, well, we're just going to use Akabash instead. And they find their app goes way faster. They're like, our app goes like, you know, twice as fast. It's like not nearly as laggy. Everything is great. How is that so much faster? But Akabash is built on SQLite. Like, it uses Frank Kruger's great SQLite wrapper library. So how is that possible? That doesn't make any sense. Like, using this library on top of SQLite is faster than SQLite? Huh? I thought SQLite was fast. Like, isn't that the thing? Like, SQLite super fast? Well, it is, if you use it right. So if you think about, like, why don't people use, like, if SQLite is so fast, then why don't people use it for, like, you know, their website? Or, like, you know, why doesn't, like, you know, Facebook use it for, like, hosting all their data, right? Or, like, all these huge websites. Why don't they use SQLite? It's really fast. That's what I heard. Star. SQLite is fast when you use transactions properly. And here's the middle one that's the gotcha. That's the important one. Access SQLite on a single thread. And that's the reason why we don't see SQLite used in production at huge, giant websites, or any website, because it turns out that most websites have more than one user. SQLite is very slow when you access it on more than one thread at the same time. It has a big, giant lock, and it locks the entire file. It will not go snappy in any way. Use transactions properly, access SQLite on a single thread, and prepare commands ahead of time. Those, like, the first one's easy to mess up, and we'll see later. The third one is kind of like the least important one, preparing commands ahead of time. It's a little bit more efficient. SQLite is not fast when you just issue commands. So if you just like do inserts or selects or whatever, and you don't think about transactions, SQLite's like, well, they issued a command, there's no transaction, I guess I gotta make one, because SQLite doesn't do things outside of transactions. Like, SQLite is an ACID compliant database, like every other like big database, and so all things that change or read data have to be in a transaction. SQLite will say, oh, there's no transaction, they didn't create one, I'm going to make one. And creating a transaction is kind of an expensive thing to do, especially when you're creating thousands of them in a row because you're not creating transactions, you're just issuing commands, and it's like, oh, I gotta create a transaction, that's done. Oh, I gotta create a transaction, that's done. I gotta create a I can't even say it fast. It's really slow. SQLite is not fast when you call into SQLite from a bunch of background threads at the same time. So like I said, SQLite really wants you to access it on a single thread. And that sounds like a reasonable like requirement, but you find out that accidentally using SQLite wrong is easy. And I left out wrong. Accidentally using SQLite incorrectly is easy. Accidentally using SQLite incorrect, wrong, is easy. There we go. Perfect. So this is an application that's near and dear to my heart, or that I at least spend a lot of time staring at, is Slack. And so imagine that you're implementing Slack. It kind of doesn't matter how it works. And so imagine that you're going to implement this using like an MVVM framework. It kind of doesn't matter. So you might make like a call to load some messages, right? So you're going to make this REST call, and it's going to come back with a bunch of messages, and you want to display them in the UI. And so you'll probably have like a class that's called like MessageSelfViewModel, right? And so you're going to take every message in this array, and you're going to create a MessageSelfViewModel. And you're going to call new on it, and it's going to be like, haha, I've got a new view model. Each of those view models, and so maybe you do that on a background thread, because we want to run this in the background, so we're not going to block the UI. We create that in the background thread, and we use task because, you know, we use async await because that's really cool. So every message instantiates a message self view model. Message self view model says, like, oh, well, I've got like some text, I've got an avatar, I've got a title or a username. I gotta download the image for the username. And so every cell wakes up and says, like, I'm gonna download an image. And so you're like, okay, well, you know, I'm not gonna download these images every single time. I'm gonna write this cache library. And so this cache library is gonna save stuff in SQLite. And so you write some method that's like, okay, like I'm gonna make an insert, I'm gonna look it up, and like if it's already there, I'm gonna like hand it back. And you're calling that from the constructor of the message cell view model. Every single message cell view model is doing this at the same time, because you've created like, you know, 15, 20 message cell view models. They're all accessing SQLite at the same time. Bingo bango, we are now accessing SQLite on more than one thread. So that's really easy to do. And it's really hard to try to manage your entire application, all these different pieces that are trying to access the same shared resource. Because at the end of the day, there's only one disk. There's only one SQLite. And so you could do some kind of clever things, right? You could split up this rule about accessing SQLite applies per database, right? So we could split up databases. We could try to make sure that kind of like ad hoc way, I know all the images are gonna be accessed one way, so like put that into a database and like, and you'll split it apart, and then you'll find that split doesn't work right now. So what do we do? So we'll get into a few things to make SQLite faster. This is like, I didn't know where to put the slide, so it's kind of like, this is like make SQLite faster the easy way. So SQLite by default starts up in like very conservative mode, which is a very reasonable default. It will be very careful to make sure all of your data is written to disk. And depending on the kind of data you're saving, maybe you don't care as much. So if you're saving like cached avatar images, if your database gets corrupted or if it drops records, YOLO, it's fine. It's not a big deal. So SQLite has different modes that it can operate in. And this one is a little bit more less conservative, be less safe. And so certain databases might be reasonable to do that. So another thing we can do is to make sure we prepare statements. And this is another easy like trick, right? So if we're making the same select query all the time. The way that a database works is you give it some text, right? You give select star from whatever, where, something, question mark, in, blah, blah, blah. And so the SQL engine does like two steps. It parses that and creates what's called an execution plan. And so it's like, all right, when we execute this command, I'm gonna do these steps. And then you can actually, like in most databases, you can like give it a query and then see the execution plan. Because the execution plan is a good, will tell you things like, are they using indexes properly? Am I going to like run down every item in this table looking for stuff? Maybe. So if you don't prepare statements, SQLite has to keep creating the same execution plan over and over and over again. Because it doesn't know what you're gonna give it, and so it's like, oh, well, I'm just gonna create the same thing. Some databases are smart and cache execution plans, but like whether it's smart or not, we can like you can't beat zero for optimizing, so let's like just prepare it ahead of time. Key value stores in particular only have so many queries. Like there's only like get, set, and delete. So we can just create them all on startup. One trick of SQLite is if you have outstanding statements and you don't destroy them, and then you're like, please close the database, SQLite's like, well, they've got outstanding commands, so I better wait. And so it will actually wait and block closing the SQLite database until you close them all. So you have to destroy them on exit. So Akabash internally uses the raw SQLite API, which is like a super, super thin layer above the C API, because I was like, well, if I'm going to rewrite it, I may as well rewrite it super fast. And yeah, so this is what it looks like. And this is like almost identical to what it looks like in C. And so this is a parameterized query. So even if your query has isn't completely constant, we can use SQLite's parameterized queries. So each one of these question marks is something we can fill in later. So we can create the command and like do the work up front, but then like just pass in pieces. And this is super common, like every other database can do something like this with different syntax. It's also very important for security because in general in a database, like you don't want to, like the SQL injection attack is like a classic like way to get hacked. And so this is the actual code for, I believe, inserting to actually run the command. And so SQLite's raw API is not a joy to behold. It's very ugly. So the idea is that we've got this operations. We've got a list of like things we want to insert. We're going to take those parameters, those question marks, and like bind to them. We're going to say like, okay, question mark number one is v.key, and question mark number two is null, and question mark number two is maybe something else. 3, 4, 5. We call this command called step, which is like the kind of like do it method. And so it's called step because if like you do a select and you return more than one thing, step will step you through each row. So like a step of an insert is just like there's only one step, which is like, you know, like you see, you run an insert and it's like one row inserted, five rows inserted, blah, blah, blah. The step will get you back like the five. And so, and the finally is like we need to clear out this, make this command forget its parameters, like just go back to the way it was. Another tip for making SQLite faster is to use less transactions or to group things into transactions. First, use transactions. As I mentioned earlier, transactions are important. So when I first wrote Akabash, I didn't know anything about databases, and I still don't know really anything about databases, but I kind of like fake it. And so I didn't know any of this stuff, and I was just like, oh yeah, insert, that's cool. Like just insert, insert, insert. And so the first version of Akabash didn't use transactions at all or like any of this clever stuff that I'm describing. It was very naive and like did silly things. And so we're like, oh, how can we make this faster? this library is really slow and it's supposed to be fast. What's the deal? How can we be more efficient than keep constantly running single SQL statements? And so I was like, well, first I learned about transactions. I'm like, oh, I'm a dope. I wrote this code that is really slow. So I'm like, okay, how can I put transactions into Akabash when the model is a key value store? So we're like, insert key, read key, delete key. These are very like single, these don't map very well to transactions at all, right? Because we're only doing one thing at a time. And this one thing is really small. So it's hard to put that into a transactional model. So the first thing I did was to add bulk operations. So bulk operations were just like, well, what if you want to insert like 10 keys at the same time? And so if you do that, then you can do all the keys in a single transaction. The bummer is, if one fails, then we have to roll them all back. So if we have 9 keys that succeed and 1 key that fails, we have to throw away those 9 keys that were successfully inserted and tell the caller that like you just have to try again. Sorry. So now the API looks more like that. So you have a get method that just returns a byte array, or a get method that turns a dictionary of string to byte arrays. So you give it a list of keys, and it says like this key was that, this key was that, this key was that. And the same thing with insert. So going back to our original problem, remember that we've got our application architecture has all these threads going, and then we're calling into a single database, and we're calling it on more than one thread, and it's really hard not to do that. So concurrency is still not solved in the sense that we haven't made our applications, like the users of our library, their lives any easier, right? They still have to try to like coordinate between all these different parts of code. It's like, okay, you're gonna do one thing on this thread, and then you over here, you can do this thing on the one thread, and then you can, it's really easy to get different parts of your code have to know about each other to try to coordinate for performance. And that's a real bummer. Like, I heard this one quote from I think it was a Strange Loop. It was a Google engineer. Google engineers always present on stuff that you can't have, which is like the worst. Like, so he's talking about some database that's super cool, Google, and he's like, oh yeah, here's the paper, and she's like, oh, where is it? Is it open source? And they're like, no, you can't have it. I was like, okay, cool, that's great. But he said this thing that stuck with me. He said, you always want to try to push complexity as low in the stack as possible. And so the idea being that if you solve something complicated once, that means only, if you solve something complicated low in the stack, that means only one person has to think about it. And the people above you, your users, don't have to solve this problem. If you push complexity up, it means that every user has to solve this problem themselves, right? And they all, like, now instead of one person doing hard work, you have to make, like, all your users do hard work. And that's a bummer. We want to make it so that one person has to do a bunch of hard work, but then once it works, then everyone else can pretend that they don't have to think about it, right? And so that's kind of like one of the philosophical things that I try to bake into all the libraries that I write, is like, make it so that developers can just, they can do something really like naive or simple or like easy, and then just fix it up behind the scenes, right? Like make it work even if the original code is written a really straightforward way, because that means it's easy to understand. Straightforward code is great. Code that has to like deal with all this complexity all the time is not so great, because it's hard to read, it's hard to understand. We want users to be able to write super easy to understand code, and then code that's way down be super complicated and fix up everything behind the scenes to make it fast anyway. So if you're like, well, I've got all these requests from different threads, how can I solve this, and you're a kernel developer, you would already know the answer to this, because you'd be like, oh, I've done this about a bajillion times. Use a queue. So this pattern of having requests come in, you stuff them into a queue, and then process them, and then send back the result, is like, you do this constantly. Like, that's all a kernel is a bunch of queues that like take requests and like pipe them and return results. Like, every driver in the world is just like, input a queue, take something, transform it into something else, send the result back. NTFS is a queue that takes file reads and turns them into drive reads and writes. Every driver in the world is just a queue. So what can we do? So we, in Akavach, will create every single cache, and by default there's like three, and so they don't get created until you access them, but every cache gets a single dedicated worker thread. So it's easy to solve concurrency if you only have one thread. So problem solved, we did it. And this doesn't end in the order. That queue is a list of operation to run plus task completion source to notify. It's actually an async subject from Rx, but we're going to talk about task completion sources because it's more common. And we'll talk about what a task completion source is if you haven't heard of it in the next slide. So that single thread is the only thread to touch SQLite. And it just reads off the queue, operates on SQLite, and then returns the result. And so you're like, well, how can I asynchronously return a result? And the answer is task completion source. And so we only have one thread, so no concurrency problems. We've solved it. So I feel like task completion source is a highly underutilized class in Rx. How many people have heard of task completion source? Okay, so more than I thought. How many people have used Task Completion Source? Not bad. So one thing that's super, that is a common misconception is that a task represents like a thread, like it's a context, something out in like executing code. Tasks don't actually have to have an associated thread. Tasks aren't threads. Task is really, in my head, I call it a completion. Like it's a thing that is either finished or not in flight, and it has a value. It's not a monad. But it's kind of like a monad a little bit. It's not lazy, which is why it's not a monad. And I found this clip art of a box and put it on the slide because it's really a box for a future value. And so that means that we can set tasks to just be variables. And so those variables we can put into arrays, we can stuff them into queues, we can do whatever we want with them. They're not like this, like, it doesn't have this weight to it, right? It's just like a thing that holds a value. So I can create a new task completion source, and I can give it to somebody, I can return it, I can put it in an array. I could put it in an array and then return it to the caller, which is what Akavash does. So like we hold on to it to complete it later, but then we hand it back to the person waiting on it. And they have a task, they call a wait, and then they're just parked until it comes back. Now the disadvantage is when you start using task completion source like this, you can deadlock yourself, of course, because now you're responsible for making sure this task completes. Like, when you have like task.run, you're like the framework kind of helps you. It's like if you know it runs too long, you know, whatever. But now you're on the hook for making sure this completes. And the way you complete it is by calling try set value or try set exception. And annoyingly, there's another method called set value, but if you call it twice, then it blows up on you. Like, I don't know why. Why would you have that method? I don't know. Like, try set value, try set exception. There's another super cool class called blocking queue. And so blocking queue is really useful. It's in the .NET framework 4.5. How many people have heard of blocking queue? A little less, yeah. So blocking queue is like a queue, but if you try to pull, you can block it on either side. I block it on the negative side of going to zero. So like if we try to pull an item from the queue and there are no items, we will wait the thread will sit there and do nothing until there is an item in the queue. And that's super useful for this pattern, right? Because we've got this worker thread, we don't want it to like wake up and like sit there and like wake up every second and like ask if there's an item. We don't want that to happen because that's really inefficient, especially on a phone. Like if you wake up every like n seconds, then no, you destroy their battery, that's bad. So we just want to like, we want this thread to like park, do nothing until there's an item in the queue to do something with. And so we will like say, give me a single item, and if there's no item, just like make me wait until there is one. And so somebody inserts an item, we wake up, we're unblocked. And then if we succeed, we're going to try to fetch 31 more. And if that doesn't work, just give us as many as possible, empty the whole thing. Up to 31. We're going to create a transaction, a SQLite transaction, run all 32 of those commands, or however many we got, drop the transaction, or like complete the transaction, complete all the task completion source associated with it, send all the results back, because we finished, and then go back to one. So we've got this loop that's like sitting here like waiting, waiting, waiting. Oh, cool, I got stuff to do. Give me as much stuff to do as possible. Create a transaction, run the commands in SQLite, and then go back to the top. Ta-da! So that's super cool. That means that you can call SQLite now from as many threads as you want, and then we'll just like mush them together and make it work, and the application doesn't know. Now, there's like a disadvantage to this, in the sense that like, so like the original V1 version of Akavash didn't know about threads, didn't do this trick. And so there's still a certain amount of latency associated with this, right? Because we've called a method, and the fastest thing we could do is instantly ask SQLite, please do this right now. We didn't jump threads. We didn't. There's a latency to saying, like, pushing it onto a different thread. That thread has to do a thing and then pushing it back. And so in some senses, if you were relying on some, like, an insert to just be, like, really fast and be done, or, like, more likely a git, like you're, like, reading something, and you're just like, I want this thing really fast, and I'm not doing anything else, this made you a little slower. But in the aggregate, you end up being faster. Slower in the sense of latency, not in terms of, like, processing time, but in the times of, like, wall clock time, you take, like, a, you know, like a stopwatch and sit there, click, click. Oftentimes, like latency is the thing that is way harder to fix in modern computing because, like, CPUs are really fast. Like, we don't really care about CPU time. We care about, like, wall clock time from, like, the time I click that button to the time that a thing happens. And so there's advantages and disadvantages of this approach. Most of the time, in practice, you know, when you're using this library a lot, you're going to be using it in, like, loading stuff, right? And so, like, that is where we're going to do way better because now we're loading, you're calling probably gits, lots of gits at once. Cool. So we've got these items in a list, and we've got 32 items at most, right? And we can do another clever trick that's even better than, this is already pretty good, but we can actually do even better. So let's think about those 32 operations. So this is like a visualization of our queue in order. And so we might have something like write bar, read foo, read bar, read baz. And so we have these items in a list. And so, like, we're about to run down this. We've got a transaction set up. We're about to run down these items. What can we do with these items? There's because this data is related, we can do a cool trick. We don't even need to read bar, because we already know what it is, because they just wrote to it. So if we see a write and then later a read for the same key, we can just complete the read immediately, because we already know the answer, because it's a write. And so now we've smooshed this queue down one item. We just saved one SQLite select statement. So that's pretty cool. We can keep, there's all kinds of variants of this plan, so we're going to see a few more. If we do a write, and then a read bar, and then a delete foo, we never needed to do the write. We just forget about the whole thing. So now we've stripped two operations, and now we have just a read bar. So this doesn't always work. So if you apply the same logic, you'd be like, well, delete write, deletes cancel writes. Ha, I did it. And now we have one read left, but it failed because we didn't actually do the write because the read depended on the write. So because our algorithm was incorrect, that read that should have worked in the naive case failed, didn't work. So we must respect request ordering. So the ordering in which you call writes and reads matters. It's not arbitrary because writes affect reads. Does that make sense? Does this all make sense to people? Is it like people very confused? Okay, cool. I have no idea. I should have asked that earlier. So, but the trick is that key value stores are very simple. And one of the things we can take advantage of is that key value stores only have data dependencies between identical keys. So foo never affects bar. Foo only affects foo. So because I wrote this code like 3 years ago, I had to dig up a lot and figure out how this actually worked again, because I totally forgot. But I managed to like figure it out. And so this is what Akabash actually does. And the cool thing about this algorithm is that it's really easily testable, because all you're doing is taking a list and then turning it into a different list. So when we go to test operation coalescing, is just like taking lists and squishing them into different lists. And so it's really easy to test because I don't have to like spin up threads or try to like call things in different orders to try to like make like kind of like rig this list using timing, because that'd be really like unreliable and tricky. It's just taking lists and turning them into different lists, which is cool. So, what we actually do. So, we group by the key, but we maintain the original order. So that means we do a link group by statement, but we make sure group by normally doesn't care about which order the keys are in. Our group by tries to maintain, if you see bar first, then bar has to be first in the list. So we take all the bars in this list. This is our imaginary queue on the left. And then we group them by key. So now we've got all the bar operations, we've got all the foo, we've got all the bads and the bams. And so now we've got, and these lists are in order. So write bar and read bar is in the same order as the original list on the left. So the first thing we can do is dedupe operations that do the same thing in a row. And you're like, well, why would you have like two people reading the same key at the same time? That's dumb. Like, why, who would write that code? And the answer is that nobody would write that code, but it's super easy to imagine different parts of the same code base executing at the same time, saying like, please give me foo. So you gotta imagine, you gotta remember that these items, even though they look like they're like in order, like one person ran them, they could be coming from all over the code base, doing like different pieces of the code doing different things. But we happen to get them in this order, and so we're gonna process them in this order. Because assumedly, like we'll have like one piece of the code, and it's going to call a bunch of operations in a certain order and care about the ordering. So we have two read foos in a row. Well, that's easy. We can just read foo once and then give the answer to both people waiting. So that's like an easy win. We'll like knock off that first read foo. That's one read we don't have to do. So then you can imagine we'll just take the first item in every piece of this list. Write bar, read foo, read baz, invalidate bamf. So we're gonna take, we're gonna go through each item in this group by and say like item.first. We're gonna collect those up. And we'll try to smush them together. And so what we can do is we can do a select in statement. So we can like say select key and value when it's one of foo or bar. Select blah from blah, where key in foo or bar. And actually, we have like up to 32 slots for select in statements. Because often, if you look at the actual pattern of how people use it, everyone will be reading different keys. And so if they're all reading different keys at the same time, we can smoosh that into like one select statement. Because it's all reading separate keys, we can just say, just give me any of them that match. So in practice, this is really efficient. This is like the thing that gets us all the speed, is being able to take a bunch of unrelated reads and then put them into one select statement. So we read foo comma baz, that's one select statement. We do one insert write to bar, and invalidate, in the code, Akabash calls delete is invalidate, right? Because it was a cache, and so we're saying like this key is invalid. So invalidate and delete are kind of the same thing. In practice, it's a little different because we can, like, invalidate means that, like, the next get will not return a key. Like, we could, like, theoretically, like, not delete that key and, like, leave it around. Kind of like when you, like, had your old, like, voice messages and you could listen to the tape and even though it was deleted, it wasn't really deleted kind of thing. Anyway. Anyone under, like, 30 has no idea what I'm talking about with, like, tape recorder and, like, voice messages. It's fine. I'm an old person. We remove the first set of keys. Now we've got the second, like, skip one, take one, like the second index, which is just read bar. And we'll keep just like looping, grabbing the first item in our lists for each group until we run, like everyone's empty. So the final result is we turn this queue of six items into four SQL statements. That's not bad. This example is kind of a little bit contrived because I want to demo everything, but in reality, like you'll see like these bursts of activity on completely unrelated keys, and so this algorithm is pretty effective. And so when I was first doing this work, I made some graphs, and I have no idea what they mean, but I'll try to interpret them for you because I did not take any notes. So this is a log graph, and so the idea is that every single, like we want to see how this performance scales over time. So if you read 5 keys, it should be, and then you read like 500 keys, it should be relatively, like you take the time for 5 keys and the time for 500 keys, and it should be a factor of 100. It shouldn't be a factor. If your code doesn't scale well or has something weird associated with it, this line won't be straight, it'll be like, you know, like something odd will happen. And you can see in this graph that like the end of the day, like SQLite scales very well because SQLite is very well written. And people have cared about scaling and stuff like that. And so like at the bottom, in this graph generally shows what we expect. And so this graph graphs a bunch of things. It graphs like the time of like simple time at the bottom, which is just like literally like calling gets over and over again on a single thread. That's like the slowest you can do. And then I tried an experiment where I just like, I don't care about SQLite's lock. I'll just spin up like 50 threads and like call into it with single calls. And then at the bottom, we have the yellow one, which is bulk, which means that like it's like kind of the most efficient we can do, like because we're like doing reads of 32 at a time, like explicitly. So like we're never going to be able to beat that because it's like the most efficient you can do because you're like explicitly saying like I'm doing 32 things at a time, bam, bam, bam. And the ones in the middle are NG and NGC, and that's the new version, like the thing I've described to you with the queue, and the NGC is the thing I've described to you with coalescing. And it mostly lines up how to expect. Like coalescing is always slower than bulk, but faster than parallel and simple. Except for sometimes when it's not, because also I'm not a statistician or good at measuring things. So this graph is probably full of it. But it did what I wanted to, so I'm going to show it to people. And similarly, the write scale did similar things. Bulk is faster than everything else. A lot of these things, you see at the beginning, like 1 is always slower than 10, and you're like, how is 1 slower than 10? That makes no sense. Because 1 gets all the startup time associated with it, whereas like 10 gets that time knocked off. And so 1 is unduly affected by like time, like all the like SQLite initializing its own stuff, like loading assemblies, stuff like that. But then we see as we go up that this graph does what we expect, that reading more stuff takes longer. And then bulk is at the very lowest because bulk is the best you can do, and NG and NGC are in the middle, and the slowest ones are the simple and the parallel, the way that Akabesh 1 used to work. So that's pretty cool. Your app takes advantage of bulk operations automagically, without you having to code it in, without having to think about bulk operations. You just get it for free, essentially, or like a one that's almost as good. You take advantage of transactions automatically. You don't have to think about transactions when you're trying to write your database. Or like you're trying to write your application, you don't have to like think about like who else is using transactions or like how to manage transactions between different parts of the code base. And that's pretty cool. And that's how Akabesh was fast. Ta-da. Thanks, so you can read this code on Akabesh. I'm at PolicyBats on Twitter and GitHub and other places that have screen names. Thank you so much for your time. Questions, comments, concerns, rants, tomatoes to throw? I think we have a mic somewhere. I'm not sure about this whole sitch, but just be loud. I'll repeat your question.
What did you pick 32
as? Well, so I wanted a nice round number. So it's kind of either 32 or 64, and the problem is the higher you go, the more likely it is that one of those will fail, and then you'll roll back the whole thing. And so like there's a balance between like bigger batches means that it goes faster, but it also means that you could blow it up faster. So, yep.
First off, thanks for Akabesh and Splat. It's great libraries. We have some databases that are a lot more complex than key value, and they have high read contention and very low write contention. Mm-hmm. So we serialize the writes, and then we allow reads from, you know, all different threads.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thought on that? I mean, sight unseen, would you say that that's wrong, and we should do it this way on a single thread, or could something like that be very performant? It's working for us, but you know, I'm always open for making it better.
Sure. It's not wrong. I mean, so if it works, it works. And it depends on like the kind of data you're storing and like your performance like requirements. It just ends up that it's a little harder to like coordinate that. And so like serializing writes and like having multi-threaded reads is an entirely reasonable thing to do. Depending on how you rig SQLite, I think that works maybe. I remember trying this once, and actually, like, it locked it anyway, which was weird. Because I also had the same thought, but I don't know. You'd have to look into it. I mean, you can easily like see like do a bunch of reads from threads and see like watch the CPU usage graph, and if you see that it looks like a staircase, then you're like, oh, like. Which Visual Studio had used to have this amazing tool called Concurrency Visualizer. It was like the best thing in the world. And then they're like, well, this isn't super useful. We'll just remove it. I'm like, it used to be in Ultimate SKU, but then now it's like in the gallery. But if you can find it, that's like the best thing in the world because it shows all the threads and it shows what they're doing like as like a graph over time. And it shows the kind of thing they're doing, like CPU, IO, being blocked. And it'll show you like I'm blocked and I was unblocked by this thread who was doing this other thing. It's so useful. It's like incredibly like it's the best thing. I cannot say enough good things about Concurrency Visualizer, but it only works for like Windows and it only works for like desktop apps, and you have to like, if you can set it up, you can set up your code in a test runner, like in a PCL, and test it. But concurrency visualizer is great. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time and for coming out.